Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Irish Economics Podcast. Today we're going to talk about tax. I'm joined by Dr. Carina Dourley and Dr. Barra Rowntree, who are Senior Research Officer and Research Officer respectively with the Economic and Social Research Institute. We discuss why we need taxes, why we need to get it right, and what can happen when we get it wrong. So these are all interesting things, and also something that's very topical and interesting is why it has been very important in helping protect the vulnerable during the COVID-19 crisis. So we discussed some of the tools that are used to understand the tax benefit system, particularly microstimulation. Now that's the workhorse when it comes to analysing a lot of tax and welfare changes. And we provide an introduction on how it can be used to give some insights that are inaccessible by many of the more commonly employed methods. Carina and Barra take us through some of their work, and this is an area which I've worked on myself and I pitch in where I can. So a quick reminder before we start that I have a Patreon at www.patreon.com/IrishEconPod. That's patreon.com/IrishEconPod. If you enjoy the podcast to the value of a cup of coffee a month, Patreon is a way to say thanks. I'm very grateful for the 6 patrons who've signed up so far. It's a small token, but means a lot in keeping everything going. Okay, so without further ado, I'll leave you and let you enjoy the conversation. The first thing we were going to discuss was just the issue of looking at the tax benefit system and how important that is and designing a good tax benefit system. So I think, Barra, you were on the chop here to try and see, well, to try and help us explain, well, what constitutes a good tax benefit system, or what are the goals of a good tax benefit system?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the state last year raised around 70 billion in taxes and spent around 20 billion on transfers to individuals and households through the Department of Social Protection, Department of Employment Affairs and Social Protection is now called. And so, you know, that's a really substantial amount of money, and it's therefore really important how it raises that money and what it does with it. And I think you can kind of look at the system as broadly having 2 goals. So that's one way of looking at it, and that's to redistribute resources between people with much to people without much, and also then providing insurance. And so we can kind of go through them in turn. And so, you know, in terms of redistribution, I think one way that it's useful to look at what the system does is if we look at the distribution of income before tax and benefits, Ireland's one of the least equal countries in the EU. So that's if you use the, you know, look at the Gini coefficient, which is probably the most common measure of income inequality that's used by social scientists. Not necessarily the best, but it's certainly the most common. And so if you look at that, we're up there in 2017. It depends exactly how you measure, but we're at the top of the table. We're in the top three or so, however you measure it. But once you take away taxes and add on welfare transfers and pensions, we drop back down to mid-table. So very much in the middle of European countries. And so, you know, in numerical terms, that, you know, you can see that as the tax and welfare system redistributing resources. And to give a sense of the scale of that redistribution, it reduces the Gini coefficient from 0.544 to 0.306 in the estimates of these. So that's around 40%. So that, I think, that really can give us a scale of, you know, one thing that the tax and welfare system does is to redistribute, and it does that by significantly reducing inequality.
So we're reducing the difference between the rich and the poor by 40%, essentially. Or we're taking out that inequality by 40%.
Yeah. And so, you know, so those are big numbers. I think is maybe the best way to look at it. To go down by that much of the Gini coefficient, you know, to get small moves of even one percentage point would be quite big. To get it down by 40% is really, really substantial. But that kind of gives you a sense, I think, of, you know, the system has that role of redistributing resources around. It taxes those who have lots of resources at a point in time, and it transfers that to people who don't. And I think kind of that kind of leads into then the other important role of the tax and welfare system, which is providing insurance to individuals and families. And so I think that you can kind of look at this in two ways again. So one aspect of this is kind of a formal type of insurance where people pay PRSI, pay-related social insurance contributions, and you pay them during working life, and that entitles you to contributory benefits, both in working life, so things like job seekers benefit if you lose your job, but also in retirement, like the contributory state pension. So paying PRSI through your life entitles you to that. So from that point of view, you can kind of look at what the system does as in part insurance, but it also does this in kind of more of an informal way. So the state provides lots of means-tested benefits that you're entitled to regardless of whether you paid sufficient PRSI contributions. So that's things like job seekers allowance rather than benefit, disability allowance, rent supplement, one parent family payment, and then also there's a non-contributory pension. If you haven't built up enough of entitlement to the main one, so that the contributory one, and so those are kind of financed out of general taxation, and so what you can think about then is what the system is doing is by taxing people when they're in work, in paid work, and they're earning money, and then providing kind of essentially a consumption floor for when they're not. The system is kind of providing this informal insurance, and that is not directly linked, but what it is doing is providing that consumption floor so that if you experience a change in your circumstances, if you're hit by, you know, a disability or a health shock in your life, that there is this kind of consumption floor there. And that's a really important and valuable role of what the system does. And maybe the one that we look at less, not even as economists, but certainly in terms of public debate, I think emphasis is on redistribution. But that insurance is really an important aspect of what is done.
Sure. That's really interesting, because I would always have thought of it, and I think a lot of people would think more in terms of redistribution and maybe evening out different, like helping people who are maybe less well off or need a helping hand. But this aspect of insurance and sharing the risk with, like, socializing the risk that some people might hit a health shock or some people might hit some sort of unforeseen impact, that it plays that role.
And I suppose, like, so I think maybe people do look at the formal element in terms of PRSI and say, you know, well, I paid into the system, so I'm entitled to take stuff out. But there's also this more, I think, larger and in a way more important informal role, in that even if you don't make those contributions, just the system operates in such a way that it does socialise that risk. And the state is very well placed to take on that risk and be the provider of that one. But it does, so, you know, in order to do that, it needs to levy taxes and it needs to means test benefits. And that inevitably affects the decisions that individuals and families make over a huge range of things, like, you know, from how much or whether they work at all to when they have children to how much they invest in education and training. So from that point of view, then, I think it's really important to examine the design of that system and ensure that it's achieving the things that we want it to achieve with the lowest possible cost or the least possible number of unintended consequences. And
we're thinking about tax benefit system in terms of sharing or maybe socializing risks and helping those who need a helping hand. But by imposing these policies, we are changing the incentive, or we're affecting the incentives faced by individuals. So basically, if you have a certain cost or certain sort of tax burden at a certain level, that might affect your incentive. Maybe incentives to work is one people always talk about, I suppose, or other incentives. And I think, Karina, you've done work on this or something like this in terms of the incentives, and maybe you could tell us something about what a good incentive is, and maybe then, and then talk about some of these sort of perverse incentives that people try to avoid.
Sure. So, let me give you an example of a policy that can have important behavioural implications. So this is social assistance. So some research I did a couple of years ago looked at the behavioural impact of the French social assistance scheme. And social assistance is like a benefit of last resort. So if you've exhausted your entitlements to all other benefits, or if you're just not entitled in the first place, you get social assistance. And the French scheme, the revenu minimum d'insertion, as it was called at the time, it's quite like schemes in place in other countries like Canada, Denmark and Luxembourg, in that it has an age condition. So if you're age under 25 and you have no children, you're not entitled to French social assistance. And the reason for including an age condition like this is really to encourage young people to join the labour market, because once they are attached to the labour market, they're less likely to leave. So what we found was that there was actually a significant decrease in employment at age 25 for the least educated in France. So about 7 to 10% decrease in employment. And what was happening really was that a proportion of young high school dropouts were actually waiting to turn 25 in order to avail of social assistance. And I don't just think that they were kind of, you know, just mechanically waiting until their 25th birthday and then dropping out. What was happening really was that because these people were low earners, they were more likely to be on short-term contracts, they had less attachment to the labour market. What happened is they just didn't search as intensively for their next contract as they approached their 25th birthday. So we do see that, and because they knew that this safety net was coming up. So they had this safety net to fall back on once they turned age 25. And the design of this policy actually distorted individual job search behaviour at a pretty crucial time for career development. And so that, I suppose that's kind of a good example of where there was a disincentive and maybe somewhat unintended disincentive. But actually the reform of that policy, which happened in 2009, sort of corrected that. So what they did was they said, OK, now you get to keep a part of this social assistance benefit when you take up a job. So it became like an in-work benefit. And this actually increased. So you still had this safety net there for people who needed it. But in-work income was then higher compared to out-of-work income for people who joined the labour market. So there was this extra incentive to work because you got to retain some of this assistance. And so that was probably a good example of this, where policy was used to increase incentive to work and work very effectively.
People always think about these incentives and think, well, they think about it in a conscious decision, but it sounds more like that this was just something in the background that just, it sort of guides people maybe away from what would happen otherwise. It's not necessarily a conscious decision.
That's right. And I mean, it can be hard to evaluate what the counterfactual is, right? So we don't know for sure what would have happened if, let's say, this social assistance was extended to everybody. So, you know, if you were entitled to it from age 18, it's likely there that the employment effects would have been even larger, right? So there would have been decreased incentive both to find a job and to stay in a job after age 25. But it's quite difficult to know what the counterfactual is. So obviously, policymakers have to, you know, use their best judgment and the evidence available in designing these policies, and sometimes there are unintended consequences like this one that need to be corrected at a later date.
And just before we move on, so that paper used regression discontinuity, isn't that right?
For the
data nerds here, I'm a big fan of that method. I think it's really cool. But could you tell us a bit about how you actually, you know, estimated your effect?
Yeah, so I mean, I really like regression discontinuity as well, because it gives you this lovely visual effect that's very easy to see and to understand as well, I think. So the major assumption underlying regression discontinuity, and for the purpose of this paper, was that 24-year-olds are essentially the same as 25-year-olds in most characteristics, right? So you would expect that employment probabilities would be sort of stable across these two age groups, in the absence of any kind of distortionary policy. The thing for regression discontinuity design is you need a really large sample size, right, in order to get like quite a robust effect. So we use the French census data, which is great, very big sample size. We had a quarter of the population, so about 14 million observations. So we were able to do this nice subgroup analysis where we compared 24, like in its most basic form, you're comparing the employment rate of 24-year-old high school dropouts to 25-year-old high school dropouts. And the effect was it was quite robust. You could see it even in descriptive statistics, looking at raw employment rates, fitting more sophisticated models later on showed effectively the same effect. So that's kind of the nice feature of regression discontinuity design, you know, a natural experiment like that, is you can visualize and interpret the results quite easily. So I used regression discontinuity for the first part of that evaluation, so looking at the effect of the existing policy. But and that's because there was data available. So we had data four individuals who were, you know, the population that was subject to this policy. But for the reform where the policy was turned into an in-work benefit, we didn't have data. So there we had to use microsimulation, right? And this is where microsimulation becomes very handy and can be used as a tool both on its own and alongside other types of method like this. So microsimulation allowed us to construct a counterfactual. So what would have happened to their income if they had been subject to this new policy? And then using a labour supply model fitted to this new distribution of income, you can look at how this would affect the labour supply.
Interesting. Yeah, very nice. It's a nice combination of methods. And you actually bring us on nicely to maybe discussing some of the methods that are used for like distributional analysis and evaluating tax benefit. So you guys work in microsimulation, and I've done a bit of microsimulation as well. And one thing that I find is that a lot of like what's really in vogue nowadays is estimating the average effects and like regression discontinuity, these really nice ex post type analysis that tell us what has happened after the event, and we can look back and see what's going on. But that can answer certain questions, whereas microsimulation can then help us answer maybe looking forward ex ante type analysis, what if something happens. And especially if we're looking at maybe tax benefit type changes or something that revolves around a rule that you can actually simulate with confidence. Maybe you could tell us a bit about the sort of work you do in terms of looking at the tax benefit system when it comes to microsimulation or how you implement it.
Yeah, so I mean, I suppose I'd argue that microsimulation is a very powerful tool that can be used on its own or in conjunction with other methods, and allows you to answer these kind of what if questions. So what if we change this policy? How can we expect the distribution of income to change? How will this affect people's behaviour and so forth? So the ESRI microsimulation model is called SWITCH, and it's linked to the Irish component of the Survey of Income and Living Conditions provided by the CSO. And in its pure form, it's a tax benefit calculator linked to survey data, right? So what you can do is you can change the parameters of the tax benefit model and see how this changes the distribution of income in the survey that you're using. So I've given you the example of the French social assistance research. This kind of evaluation of the reform wouldn't have been possible until the data was released unless we had used microsimulations. That kind of evaluation would have been very difficult without microsimulation. Let me maybe give you one more example of where microsimulation can be useful that we've kind of been doing in the last couple of years. So we carried out some gender budgeting work at the ESRI a couple of years ago. So in this work, we took a look at how tax benefit policies over the 10-year period surrounding the Great Recession affected income of men and women separately. Okay, and to do this, what we wanted to do, we wanted to abstract from all the other changes that had happened during the Great Recession, employment, wage, demographic, etc. So what we did was apply two sets of policies to the same income distribution. So we took the 2008 policies and the 2018 policies and applied both of these to the 2018 income distribution to see what exactly the effect of changing the tax benefit policies over this period, what effect that had on men and women separately. And what we found that was women's income was disproportionately affected during the Great Recession because they were more likely to be receiving welfare payments, which were frozen in nominal terms during the period, most of the period at least. And they were also more likely to be caring for a child at a time when things like child benefit and one-parent family payments were cut. So that's kind of another example of looking at something beyond an average and something that wouldn't have been possible without the use of a model where you can actually change the parameters of the tax benefit system and apply them to the same population.
Sure. So you can get that insight into how things, not just the effect on the average individual, but how it affects individuals across the spectrum. And you can look at policy changes that are perhaps haven't happened already, which is very important when you think about when you need to make a decision, when you need to make a policy decision and you don't have that information. I think a lot of the academic work seems to be focused on, well, what has happened and getting this really clean effect. It's almost like a footballer taking a perfect free kick. Whereas sometimes you need to score the goal in different ways and you need to find out you don't actually have that pure method in place. Whereas it's still a valid insight, but it's perhaps not as pretty as maybe the regression discontinuity insight. But
you've hit the nail on the head there. Yeah. We all love a lovely, clean experimental design to get a nice, precise effect out. But in the absence of that, when you're working with exactly. What ifs and counterfactuals, microsimulation is a good tool. Although not quite as exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely very functional. But the switch model then is what's known as a static model. It's that it's a snapshot in time. You have this effect. You're looking at what happens now, and you have a counterfactual, and you compare one thing to the other. as opposed to maybe looking at more dynamic models where you want to see how things happen going into the future. If you want to see, look at, say, for example, changes throughout the life course, effects of pension policy, how it might affect maybe future generations, decisions like that. I don't know if you, either of you, have done any work in that regard, or I'm springing this question on you without any prep.
So a bunch of the work I've done has tried to look at exactly that, to try to look at, well, okay, so we typically look at inequality or redistribution at a point in time. We kind of take people's incomes as they are, or as they report them in a particular month or in a particular year. And we know that people's circumstances change a lot over time. So both because a lot of things have a steep age profile, you know, people tend to not work in their early years when they're maybe a lot undertaking education or training, and tend to then move into employment, work for a number of years. Sometimes people drop out when they have kids for a while and come back. And then as you kind of get towards retirement, people tend to kind of scale back their involvement in the labour market, or there's some people who do at least. And so that kind of means that there's really important life cycle aspects to looking at things like redistribution and inequality. And so work that I've done using both real panel data, longitudinal data over a period of about 18 years, and also then a kind of a micro simulation approach where you kind of invent essentially people, hypothetical. You can try estimate, well, what would people's lives look like over time? And looking at that, we could kind of, some of the work I've done has shown that, well, I think the big things are that inequality is a lot lower than it looks like at a point in time. That's not to say it isn't substantial, but it is less, and because people are often going through transitory shocks. So, you know, if you see people without income at a point in time, for some of those, it's because maybe they're taking a few months off between jobs, or because they're taking time off to go back maybe to education or training. But it also means that some of what the tax and benefit system, what looks like redistribution, is actually essentially payments from a person, it's kind of essentially enforced savings. It's a redistribution across one person's life. So say from their working life to their retirement. It gives you a slightly different perspective on what the tax and transfer system is doing. And it's kind of a growing area, I think, of research, both in terms of looking at income inequality and redistribution, but also then trying to say, well, we know that lots of welfare programs or taxes have important long-run effects, and that these effects can potentially be larger in the long run. That, you know, that that these dynamic effects can build over time, and that, you know, maybe it's the case that if you have lower taxes, that people invest more in education, and then also maybe, you know, the fact that it makes you get more take-home income from working today. That means you work more today, and that improves your return to working tomorrow. So there's these important type of dynamic effects that increasingly economic research is looking at when analysing the effect of tax and transfer reforms, and also then in terms of inequality and redistribution.
Okay, so I'm going to interject here for a moment to tell you a bit about spatial microsimulation. We've mentioned static microsimulation and dynamic microsimulation models, and the final type of microsimulation model is a spatial microsimulation model. And this is something which is close to my own heart, as I've done some work on this, and hopefully you can allow me to indulge myself for a moment. So essentially, a spatial microsimulation model is where we want to look at the distribution of an impact at the subnational level, be it a county-to-county level or a neighbourhood-to-neighbourhood level. But we only have the microdata at the national level. So a spatial microsimulation model is one created by reweighing the national data using regional data, such as census data. Nowadays, however, we can do that in a world of big data, and I've seen papers using really cool methods using mobile phone data and similar spatial data that can be found in everyday life. So why do we want to know the spatial distribution of impacts? Well, maybe we want to know where the poor regions are, if you want to target some sort of regional development policy. Maybe we want to target specific social services to certain areas, plan the spatial distribution of healthcare services. Spatial microsimulation gives us the evidence to make informed decisions in that regard. We can know where the vulnerable populations are, and then we can plan spatial allocation of these resources accordingly. My own applications in this field have been in the field of environmental and energy economics. My PhD was on wave energy. It was 80,000 words to say, well, how expensive wave energy is going to be. But back when I was doing that in the late noughties, wave energy was motivated in Ireland on grounds of regional development. It was very expensive, and we could have put up a lot of wind for the amount of subsidy expenditure that was willing to be put into wave energy. So this was a big question, and I used the spatial microsimulation model to see, well, what was the benefit to regional development of this investment, of this establishment of a hypothetical industry, and compare that to the cost, the subsidy cost, and the burden of that cost. Now, the cost was a subsidy that was levied on electricity expenditure. So the electricity consumer incurred an additional cost. It was an increase in the bill for everybody. And the benefit then was this localized employment. So we compared this first round benefit with this first round cost, not taking into account multiplier effects, of course. But looking at these effects, no matter what way you cut it, the cost is greater than the benefit. In terms of total cost, between region inequality, total region inequality increased. The cost is greater than the benefit in measures of regional development. So in that context, there was no industrial policy grounds for wave energy deployment looking at these first round effects. More recently, I've been doing perhaps more exciting work developing more precise methods for matching microdata to spatial regions. I spent some time at the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, where I got access to really cool climate data. And using a Mexican case study, I matched spatially disaggregated climate data with a spatial microsimulation of deprivation. So I simulated measures of deprivation and poverty for Mexico at the small area level. So why is this interesting? Well, up until now, when it comes to identifying areas that are vulnerable to the impacts of climate change, these are generally calculated according to perhaps the climate impact, the weather, the heat, the drought stresses. Efficient policy intervention then with that data is targeted at regions where distress occurs. With this new framework, we can combine the areas that are most affected by the climate shock and where that climate shock coincides with a vulnerable population. So you can target the areas that are most vulnerable to climate change. So this paper is really nice because we show how inefficient policy can be in helping those most vulnerable when we don't have adequate data to target the right populations. It's all a work in progress, but hopefully I'll be able to share more details when it gets published soon. Okay, so back to this main discussion.
But one thing, so when you look at the microsimulation, and we mentioned already that it's important in the sense that it's an ex-ante tool and you can use it to look at what's going to happen in the future. I think that's really important when you need to get analysis out quick. And that was really important when it came to COVID. And you guys had a paper on basically what the distribution impacts of the COVID policy was and maybe the immediate response. Maybe you could tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, sure. So we looked at the impact that the introduction of the pandemic unemployment payment, aka the PUP, and the temporary wage subsidy scheme. So we looked at the impact that they had in terms of, I suppose, cushioning the impact of job losses from induced by the lockdown. And we find they did a lot of work to do that. So, you know, I think
millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
I think the one that stands out to me is that we estimated that so we ran a few different scenarios, and our medium scenario probably is kind of closest in terms of the total number of job losses. Unfortunately, our high scenario was probably a bit on the low side, even for the number of people who lost their jobs or on the wage subsidy. But if we just take that medium scenario where we said around 600,000 people lose their jobs, so we found that the policy response meant that the number who lose more than 20% of their disposable income was reduced by about a third, from 400,000 families to 280,000 families. And essentially what's going on there is that because of the PUP and in particular, but also the temporary wage subsidy scheme, that really reduced the proportion of families who, by losing their job, would experience a really sharp decline in their income. Because previously they would have had to, say, rely on the job seekers payments or, you know, and essentially, in order to qualify for the job seekers benefit, it's based on the number of contributions you made 2 years ago. So anyone who would have started work in the last 2 years mightn't have been entitled to that and would have instead been had to go and apply for means tested job seekers allowance. And that would have all taken a lot of time. You know, there's the forms to fill out these to get these benefits are long, and you need to go along and provide lots of information to your local job centre. And so by introducing in particular this flat rate payment of €350 a week, the government were able to really cushion the impact on families right across the distribution, and really reduce the number who are seeing extreme losses. And so, you know, and from that point of view, the number who we estimate that the number who would have lost more than 60% of their disposable take-home income was reduced by almost half, from about 70,000 families to 40,000 families. So there's still a lot of people who are losing a lot of money, but it really that policy response was really, I suppose, swift and strong, and really was focused on getting money out there to families at short notice and not really worrying about the targeting initially. And so from that point of view, so I think we were kind of quite positive about the cushioning effect that had. And also, if you compare that response to other countries, it was able to get that money out to people much faster. You know, there's in the UK, the system of universal credit was made more generous. That's their kind of like their safety net essentially there. But it was taking several weeks, in some cases a month, for people to get that payment. And so the Irish response really was a lot swifter and was very generous, but it's also very costly. And so, you know, we estimated that because of the measures introduced, the costs of 100,000 people losing their job would be around 800 million more every quarter than it would have otherwise been. So the policy response did a lot to cushion incomes. It did so at quite significant costs, and that's going to it's going to create issues in the months, I suppose, ahead in terms of the recovery, in terms of how do we move away from that system in place, which was very much designed with being temporary, speedy, and strong, but ultimately creates other issues.
Absolutely. So that's how I would have seen it as being basically we need to get something out there quick. You know, time is of the essence, and that was the response. But now it seems to be at the stage, well, how do we tweak that for the long term, and how do we maybe progress on the pathway out of the crisis? And how would you guys see that evolving, or have you done any research on that, or heard any rumors on your travels?
Well, I mean, it's likely that these payments will be tapered or cut over the next few months. And if we take the two kind of main policies separately, from the point of view of the PUP, As the economy recovers, the fact that this payment is so generous will mean that there is reduced incentive for people to work. So research by some of our colleagues at the SRI showed that the PUP is actually close enough to the take-home income of somebody working full-time on the minimum wage. So in order to provide an incentive for people to work, particularly at the moment where there may be people may be worried about their health, maybe worried that, you know, if they go back to work, they'll be more likely to contract COVID, it is important to provide incentive to work. So right now, that's probably not much of an issue because much of the economy is still, you know, either closed or reopening very slowly. But as our recovery progresses, this is likely to be an issue, and it's something that would need to be addressed, you know, in order to encourage people to go back to work. So providing this incentive to work could be done in two ways. So either we cut the PUP, right? So we bring it back to, you know, either it's pre-pandemic level of job seeker benefit or job seeker's allowance or something in between. And this means that out-of-work income will be relatively higher compared to, or in-work income, sorry, will be relatively higher compared to out-of-work income. Another alternative would be to allow people to accumulate their PUP payment with their earnings as they go back to work. So that would also provide an incentive for people to rejoin the labour market. So that's kind of on the PUP side of things. For the temporary wage subsidy scheme, eligibility for the scheme is based on, currently it's based on firm turnover. So firm turnover had to decrease in order for firms to be eligible for this subsidy for their employees. But withdrawing it based on the same criteria would be a mistake because this would provide an incentive for firms not to increase their turnover, right? So, but the issue is as the economy recovers, the dead weight associated with this scheme is going to increase. In other words, we're going to be subsidising firms that no longer need it. And it'll be hard to tell which firms are which. So really the timing of the withdrawal of this scheme is going to be crucial. So if policymakers decide to withdraw it too soon, some firms that may have been otherwise viable, if they had continued to get it for another couple of months, they might go under. If policymakers decide to withdraw it a little later, the cost of the scheme really spirals. So that's going to be the really tricky part about withdrawing the temporary wage subsidy scheme.
And there's a lot of nuance required there to try and understand who really needs the payment. I don't envy anybody trying to make those decisions, essentially. Okay, well, that's really interesting insight. So I suppose moving on, some work that you guys have done, maybe looking at income inequality in a more general sense and how that's evolved throughout the years. Now, I know, Barry, you've done work in terms of Ireland's income inequality, how does progressed maybe over the last few decades? Maybe you could tell us a bit about some of your findings there.
Yeah, so despite the fact that kind of income inequality has been rising in most advanced economies over recent decades, and that's very much the narrative that I think people have in mind, so disposable income inequality in Ireland has actually fallen substantially over the last, you know, 30-odd years. So from between 1987 and 2017, the Gini coefficient, again, that commonly used measure of income inequality, where zero means that income is entirely equally distributed, everyone has the exact same, and one means that one person has all the income. So on that kind of scale, the Gini fell in terms of disposable income from 0.333 in 1987 to 0.306. So that's around a 10% fall, which really is quite significant, and actually it's also statistically significant. You see the same story on most other measures. So if you look at kind of, you know, decile shares of income, if you look at 90-10 ratio, if you look at all these different summary measures of income inequality, disposable income inequality in Ireland actually fell over that period, 1987 to 2017. And in fact, it's, you know, the only other country, OECD country, where disposable income inequality has fallen significantly over the same horizon as France. So, you know, our experience is really quite different to other countries, in particular, say, the US, where I think maybe, you know, a lot of discussion is about, where the Gini coefficient there has risen. The top 10% share has been rising, while median incomes have been, you know, the incomes of people in the middle have really been stagnant and even falling in real terms, accounting for price changes, depending on how you measure it. And so I think that really kind of illustrates the importance of studying what's going on here in Ireland and not just assuming that what's happening elsewhere also applies. Now that said, I think there's some caveats to that. So we have very poor data on incomes at the very, very top. And so, you know, we can't really say anything in terms of Ireland about what's been going on with the top 1 or even 0.1%. So we don't know, are they racing away from, you know, the other 99% of us or 99.9% of us? And that's something actually where I think there's scope for us to learn a lot more, because, you know, if we can get access to data collected by the revenue commissioners, in particular, if we can combine data from business records with income tax payments, with capital gains tax returns, I think there's the potential to learn more about what's going on there at the very top. Because, you know, it's now not just about employees or even the self-employed. There's now what's happening in other countries, and I think the same is likely to be going on here, but it'd be good to kind of look at this and understand this, is that there's now a significant tax advantage to taking your income in the form of dividends or capital gains tax, to having your own company, storing income in that and selling it off. And then you can pay tax on that at a reduced rate of 10%. So that's an important aspect which hasn't fed into the story really here at all. And again, I think is likely to be particularly important at the top. But it's not something we really know about because we don't have the data. And that's, I think, really... Well, it's an unfortunate thing at the moment, but there is the capacity to do that, and hopefully that's something which we can do and learn more about.
Okay, so you're after inspiring two questions. So first of all, we're talking about disposable income. So this is income after taxes and transfers. So essentially what's driving the decline in disposable income then tends to be any tweaks that have been happening with the tax benefit system. Would that be correct?
So that's one important part of it. But actually, you know, I think the story in Ireland is really interesting, and we should do more on it, and there needs to be more work done on it. Because, so kind of think what you're kind of getting at is that at the same time that disposable income inequality has fallen, market income inequality in terms of that bit that you do see on your payslip before in terms of your gross salary before taxes. Inequality in market income has been going up, so it's not it's a smaller rise. So it's, you know, the market income Gini coefficient went from 0.523 to 0.544 over the period 1987 to 2017. But you also had something kind of interesting going on there. So, we have a range of different summary measures. The Gini coefficient isn't, despite the fact that it's the only one you usually ever hear, is not the only measure. We have a range of summary measures. Some of them are kind of top sensitive to what's going on at the top, others sensitive to what's going on at the bottom. And if you look at these over that period in time, the Gini coefficient and the top sensitive measures do suggest that market income inequality has increased. But actually, you know, those measures that are bottom sensitive suggest it's actually fallen a bit. And so I've looked at this a little bit, and again, I think there's still a lot more to be done on this and the Irish experience, and I think it's a really interesting thing that people should be looking at. But what we saw in Ireland is actually stronger growth in earnings, both weekly earnings and hourly wages, at the very bottom of the distribution that was actually strongest, and at the top, and it was a little bit lower in the middle of the distribution. But so it means that there's kind of a complicated story going on there. But then also one of the factors that feeding into this higher market income inequality is the changing patterns of employment within couples. So, you know, we've seen a big rise in the employment of women in Ireland. It's really shot up. And, you know, we were really kind of laggards in that. We had very low rates of participation in the labour market among women and until quite late in the 20th century by comparison to other countries, or other European countries anyway. And you know, but one thing that is going on there is that actually we now have a lot more high income two earner couples. And so, you know, you would have been in a position where previously you were more likely to have two people in work if a family was low income. Now it's actually the other way around. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of things tied up in that. But what that does mean is that's a contributing factor to the growing concentration of market income inequality, particularly at the top, in that you do have a kind of a changing structure of families, a changing structure of the labour market, and how that feeds through is more complicated than maybe I think the kind of the story that we sometimes hear or discuss.
And you mentioned another thing there about maybe a lot of people might take their income in different ways, maybe through some sort of a company. Could you maybe just break that down a bit more, because this is a story people might be interested in hearing?
Yeah. So, there are a number of different ways you can carry out some economic activity. You can carry it out as an employee. You could carry it out as a sole trader. You could set up your own company and you could be the director of that company. And you could also employ yourself a little bit, maybe employ your spouse and children as well for a little bit. And all those different ways of carrying out, you know, you can potentially have a task, some kind of economic activity, which can be carried out in all those ways. And we actually tax each of those forms of work differently. So, you know, most people understand, you know, will be PAYE workers, and they'll understand that, oh, you know, I'm employed, I pay income tax, USC, and also PRSI, and my employer also makes a PRSI contribution. If you're self-employed, you pay income tax and USC, and you actually pay a little bit more income tax and USC than an employee of the with the same level of income would pay. But there's no equivalent of the employer PRSI. And so there's actually this big wedge in terms of just looking at activity carried out by an employed person or a self-employed person, a big wedge in the tax that is ultimately paid across those two forms. And so this isn't something just going on in Ireland. It's something that the OECD have been drawing attention to about both in loads of countries, in Netherlands, the UK. So that's kind of one aspect of it. Then another aspect is that, well, you don't only have to operate as a sole trader. You might be able to establish yourself as a company, set yourself up as the, and maybe some of your family as the shareholders of that. You take in the money, you pay yourselves a bit of salary. So you pay yourselves probably whatever the tax optimum amount is. Then you save up, pay yourself the rest in terms of dividends. Pay yourself a little bit of a dividend, and then you hold income in the company until such a time as you're willing to get rid of it. And when you do, you can then avail of what's called in here entrepreneur's relief, where you pay a reduced rate of capital gains tax on disposal of the asset, and that can lead you paying to much lower rate of tax than you would have otherwise paid if you carried out that that task as a sole trader or indeed as an employee. So there's all these kind of, there's different forms of economic activity that we tax differently and that lead to different levels of take-home income. And that's, I think, going to be, it's part of kind of the gig economy story, but it's not really one that I think we've really explored in here in Ireland as much as maybe we should.
That aspect of income is not captured in maybe the likes of the EU SIC data. So therefore, you need to have that caveat when you interpret those results, basically.
Exactly. And that becomes more important if it's growing, if this is a growing thing, as it may be.
Absolutely.
Again, we're not sure because the data at the moment isn't available for people like Crean and myself and our colleagues here at the Israel to study, or indeed people at UCD or all the other research institutes in the country. I'm sure we'd all love to have access to that.
Absolutely, yeah. No, that's interesting insight. Okay, so before we wrap up then, you both worked in terms of looking at impact of gender and in relation to tax benefit systems. And I think you've both done similar papers looking at second earners and how changes, correct me if I get this wrong, but changes in how the tax system is structured between sharing tax credits between two earners in a household versus measuring it individually affects the incentive to work. Would that be correct?
That's right.
Maybe tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so let me talk about individual taxation then. So before 2000, tax credits and bands were fully transferable between members of a couple in Ireland. So that means that if you had a one-earner couple, the earner, who was typically male, didn't pay tax at the higher rate until their earnings exceeded twice the standard rate band. So they had twice the standard rate band to pay the lower rate of tax, and after that, they paid the top rate of tax. Then there were a series of reforms enacted in the beginning of the noughties. So the plan was to move to a fully individualised taxation system, but it actually met with a lot of public resistance because it was thought to penalise women who worked in the home. So in the end, the series of proposals or the series of policy changes was abandoned and a kind of hybrid system was introduced, and that system is still in place today. So after this series of reforms, this one earner, this earner and a one earner couple paid the higher rate of taxation when their earnings exceeded one and a third the standard rate band. Okay, and this actually substantially increased the incentive for secondary earners to work because only they could use the remaining two thirds of their standard rate band. Right, and secondary earners tended to be women. So research that I did on this reform found that this set of reforms increased the hours worked by secondary earners, so married women, by 2 hours per week. And interestingly, I found a symmetrical decrease in the hours of unpaid childcare that married women performed. That was about 2 per week as well. So this is actually a really big increase in female labour supply. To put it into context, it was about 5 percentage points, starting from a baseline, I think, of somewhere around 50%. So 50% of married women were working at the time. And after the set of reforms, it was about a 5 percentage point increase. And this is because married women in particular are very responsive to changes in the tax and benefit system. So they respond with labour supply. Men are notoriously inelastic to changes in tax benefit system. So studies across countries typically find that men respond very little to changes in tax benefit policies. Their workers are either already working full time or they're not working, and small changes to the tax benefit system have no impact on that. But women are responsible, particularly married women, and particularly when you affect something like this, like their marginal effective tax rate. So, you know, what they're going to pay in terms of taxation once they join the labour market or if they provide an extra hour of labour supply. So this is actually quite a big policy change and that did positively affect gender equality in Ireland. So you can imagine the long-term ramifications of that. You see a 5 percentage point increase in female labour supply, you know, 20 years ago. That will have had impacts on the career trajectories of these women, on their pension entitlements when they eventually reach retirement age, on, you know, the role modelling that they're providing, let's say, for children or peers or anything like that. So it's quite a big policy change.
Okay, so a large effect for a relatively, well, I suppose a hybrid policy. So there's room for a greater shift, essentially.
Yeah, I suppose I should caveat. Sorry, Bart, to cut across you there.
No.
And this series of policy changes was enacted when we had loads of money. So it's like, I mean, it was a big giveaway. So what actually happened was the standard rate band for, let me get this right now. The standard rate band for singles was unchanged. So there was no cuts made. Nobody was paying extra tax, right? It was just that, let's say the standard rate band of two earner couples was advancing at a higher rate than one earner couples. So one earner couples were kind of being left behind, but in nominal terms, they weren't losing anything. So this is kind of the policy that you can only enact when you have lots of money to spend. And that was the case, let's say, in the early 2000s.
Right. Okay. So it might be more difficult now to make a similar change. You've done a similar study, Barry. I think I remember on your paper, you looked at how it affected other decisions in the household. Is that right?
Yeah, yes, that's right. And so I think kind of it ties in really neatly to what Karina was doing in that we kind of went some of the way here in Ireland around the time of those McCreevy budgets when we had it, we were spending it, and when we weren't, we weren't. They went further in the UK, and they used to have a system of joint taxation as well, and they kind of fully moved away from it in 1990, and they brought in a full individual system of taxation. And so I suppose what I looked at is, well, what effect did this have on the employment of women, because they were the people who are largely affected by the change and would think that are more likely to respond, but not just at the point in time that this happened or in the kind of the years following it, but over the life cycle, because again, kind of comes back to what we were talking about earlier, that some policies can have really important dynamic effects. And so what I looked at was, well, how much would labour supply increase across the life cycle, and how does that interact with the decision of when to have children? Because particularly what I was interested in looking at was if in, you know, where this really kicks in, or I think where it's really relevant is when you have second earners, usually women, coming back from into the labour market after maybe taking some time off to have a kid. And a lot of them kind of come in now part-time. They come in part-time because, well, if they come in full-time, they're paying the higher rate of income tax. And, you know, then you have to have higher childcare costs as well. And so what that kind of, I think, encourages is for people to come back into labour force part-time. And we know from lots of work that's been done in the economics at the moment that that's really when the gender wage gap starts to really open up. Like, it exists a little bit beforehand, but it's really when it opens up is when women come back into the labour market. They tend to work part-time, and then as a result, they tend not to progress as fast in the career. So I think that's why, so I was kind of interested in understanding, well, if you did away with this additional disincentive, there's still many other barriers and many disincentives to go back into full-time work. And that's not to, this is just to kind of focus in on this aspect of the tax system, but there's this additional disincentive to returning to full-time work. And that's really kind of where I found the biggest effects, that essentially in the way I looked at it and the way I estimated it was that in response to this reform of getting rid of a system of joint taxation, women tended to push back the age at which they first had a kid and stay in work full time and go into and stay in work full time when they came back to work as well. So there's this important, and that had kind of this snowballing type of effect in that by working more full time, particularly over their 30s, earnings tended to be much, much higher than they would have, because that's really, you know, an important aspect of earnings growth is the kind of the returns to full-time work. And so from that point of view, the kind of work that I've done really kind of shows that the effects that we know moving away from joint to individual digital taxation can have might be even larger in the longer run because of these kind of dynamic effects.
Okay, that's, and to simulate those dynamic effects, like you simulated those dynamic effects, you weren't able to.
Yeah. Alas, the data are not good enough in the UK or here or most countries. I think, you know, it's only really in Sweden and Denmark now where we're getting towards the stage, even though we're not quite there yet, where you have wide enough data and long enough on long enough of a period of life that you can potentially look at, you know, use data to look at these things. But ultimately, you know, a lot of the time, if you want to kind of isolate the impact of a particular effect, you're going to need to undertake some kind of simulation approach or make some modeling choices. And, you know, we can't, you know, and that has its costs, but it also allows you to get at and try isolate the effect of particular reforms.
Yeah, no, there's one thing I've learned from this discussion is that to combine the simulation type papers with some sort of empirical ex post analysis, it leads to a very nice insight. And also, I think it could be more publishable.
We'll see about that, but yeah.
Well, I think we've covered everything. So, Barra and Karina, thanks very much. I really appreciate the time.
Thanks for having us on to talk about it.
Okay, so thanks everybody for listening. Quick reminder before we go that we have a Patreon at patreon.com/rsheconpod. If you want to help towards keeping the costs down, Patreon is a way to say thanks, and I really appreciate all the help that's been offered so far. Thanks everybody for listening, and all the best.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.